Let me begin by indicating that today is March 9th, 1995. This is Jim Boning speaking with Bruce Hannay in the Harbor Court Hotel in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Hannay, I know that you were born on the 9th of February in 1921. Could you tell me something about your father and mother and your family background?
Well, I was born in a small town in the state of Washington, and my father and his parents and his brothers and sisters had descended from a Scottish family which came to Nova Scotia, and after a few years there they said it wasn't any better than Scotland as far as the climate, so they started migrating west, and they spent a little time in Chicago where my father was born, and then they lived in South Dakota for a while, and finally they came to the state of Washington, where my father, leading the family, acquired a small town bank, or one that was just starting, and because he was a banker by profession, and so were the rest of his father and his brothers, and so that was his business in this small town, Mount Vernon, Washington, and it was a successful bank in a rapidly growing region. I might comment that the thing that really gave that part of the country a big boost was the Alaska Gold Rush, and people came out there and they poured through the state of Washington because that was the closest point to getting to Alaska to dig for gold. So all the towns grew, Seattle grew, everything grew. My mother was the offspring of a family of pioneers that had come from southern Indiana, and she was born in the state of Washington in 1887, before Washington was a state. And I'll tell you, the first settlement in Seattle was, I think, 1859. So she was a real pioneer.
I'll say.
And her ancestors came from the Daniel Boone family in southern Indiana, Kentucky, across the river from southern Indiana. And so we lived there, and it was pleasant being born and spending my early years in a small town. But when the Depression came along, a bank where its business was largely mortgages on farms that were owned by the Swedish farmers who had left Minnesota because they were too crowded there, and they all came out to Skagit County in the state of Washington, and they all had mortgages. And my father said, there's no way we're going to foreclose any of these mortgages. These are honest people. They'll pay it back when they have the money. But he couldn't float it because of the money requirements. So he sold the bank. I might say his father was working in the bank, and his brothers working in the bank, and his brother-in-law was working in the bank. But he sold the bank to the National Bank of Commerce in Seattle, a large bank, which had a bunch of better capitalization. And he became an officer of that bank, and we moved to Seattle. And that was fine, except that my father was killed in an accident soon after we got there. So my mother had three sons of varying ages from high school on down. I was the youngest. And she was left with the job of bringing up three boys. And she did it. So I lived in Seattle through my high school years. Okay. I was the youngest. I was the last to leave. When I used to college, first time I ever crossed the Mississippi River was going east to college.
Oh, really?
In the outskirts of Philadelphia.
Well, I wanted to, just for a moment, talk about, you received your grade school education in Mount Vernon then.
Part of it.
But most of your
education.
The first
half of it, yeah.
Was in Seattle.
Well, I got through maybe the fourth grade or something like that in Mount Vernon. And then I went to Seattle and got the rest of the grammar school education and high school.
Okay. And during your high school career, I noticed that on this form you've mentioned that both your second brother and your high school chemistry teacher had an influence on you.
Well, the teacher was very good. It was one of the public high school, Garfield High School in Seattle. And the teacher, I was pretty bright student, and chemistry teacher, one in particular, but actually both of them, I think there were two. But very encouraging. When I remember that they asked all the students, maybe just the juniors and seniors, to go around to little classes once a year where they could spend a couple of hours hearing about a profession. And they'd invite somebody in from the local community to tell them what it's like. I just assumed I'd be a banker. Everybody in my family is a banker. And I went around and I listened to the one in banking and so forth. But by the time I finished high school, I'd been so enamored of the possibility of going into chemistry because these teachers were so careful to cultivate my incipient interest, which began to emerge taking all the courses in, offered in high school. In fact, they offered me a chance to go to courses that weren't even listed as courses and just go and work in the back room and do experiments and study ahead and learn things. And so it was really quite nice because they saw that I could get through the assigned work in the chemistry classes. And the people in mathematics did the same thing, and to some extent in physics, but it was very encouraging. So I always felt that they, well, for example, why did I become a chemist rather than a physicist when I ended up later being at least as much of a physicist as chemist? It was simply because those teachers were more open in their cultivation. So I regarded them as being very important. My older brother, see, the oldest one, had gone off. He was going, taking a job and lived far away, but the next one down was a very scholarly one. He spent a lot of time trying to encourage me to learn things and do things and so forth. So it was, I'd say it was very fortunate.
Was this a large high school?
Oh, yes, it was a big public high school. Seattle at that time, I think, had a population of, I don't know, 360,000 or something, and there were 9 public high schools. And these had something like 3,000 students. And my high school had the most diverse collection of people, racially, and, well, that was good. You know, there were a lot of black students, and there were Oriental students, and it was fine. We all got along very well. But it was a good school to go to, Garfield High School. And people who went there now, I run into them from time to time, not the ones that I knew then. And I think that all of the people who went to that place are proud to claim it as their high school.
Your other brother, your older brothers, had gone on to college, so I was
assuming. Yeah, they went to the University of Washington.
Was it sort of foregone you would be doing the same thing then?
Well, they both encouraged me not to go to the University of Washington. They felt that I would do much better at a small liberal arts college with strict academic standards. And so while they didn't force me to do it, they whetted my appetite in this, and because they weren't particularly unhappy at the large state university. University of Washington today is a much stronger institution than it was then. It was not all that strong academically. Well, they both got a good education. They just encouraged me to do something different. So we talked about, and this was with my next older brother, we talked about places to go, and he said, well, the best in the country is a place called Swarthmore College in Philadelphia. And so I only applied two places. I applied to Swarthmore and Caltech, and I admitted to both of them, but I chose Swarthmore and went there as an undergraduate.
Why did you choose Swarthmore if you were admitted to Caltech?
Well, Caltech had a tremendous reputation in science, but I thought that Swarthmore would provide a more broadly based liberal education. Also, it was coeducational, which sounded like a good idea, because I was shy with girls, and I thought that maybe it would be good to be exposed to girls. Although, as it turned out, Swarthmore allowed one to specialize so much. I think I would have gotten more liberal arts courses if I'd gone to Caltech than I did get at Swarthmore, where I I took chemistry, physics, and mathematics until I was coming out of my ears.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have thought that. I'm curious as to why your brother thought Swarthmore was the finest.
Oh,
did he have any connection with it?
No, we had none at all. There are no Quakers in the family. But you could read articles, and we read articles about, and small liberal arts colleges were mentioned prominently, and invariably Swarthmore was either the top one that was named or in the top two or three, and the others were, I'm sure, very good. Haverford, another place of college, but that was all men. I mean, I could name some more. Carleton in Minnesota and Reed College in Oregon was a possibility, and maybe one or two others. But Swarthmore was always up there, and usually named number one. So I thought that I ought to go there.
How did you finance going to Swarthmore?
Well, things didn't cost as much in those days, and I had a small scholarship, but my father had left enough for my mother to take care of things pretty well, and so
okay. We
paid for it.
You said it was the first time you crossed the Mississippi was
right.
Going to Philadelphia. How did you make that trip alone, and how did you react to Philadelphia when you got there?
Well, I had my oldest brother was now working in Texas, and the middle one of the three of us was in graduate school, and he was probably at Stanford at that time. But during the summers, my mother was eager to see her oldest son. And we spent a lot of time driving around. We just get in the family car and go for a trip. We'd drive down to Texas to see my brother. And nobody had any pressing obligations. So I'd been around as far as Texas, but I'd never been as far as the Mississippi River. So when the time came for me to start at Swarthmore, my middle brother, by that time, was a graduate student at Princeton in economics. So we took the family car and just kept going, and I had my stuff in the back of the car, and my mother was on trip. She wanted to see where I was going to school, and so the two of them dropped me off at Swarthmore. My mother shed a few tears, leaving me to the tender mercy of the East. And I believe it was probably her first time over in the East. But I was sort of excited by it. You know, I'd heard of these places like New York and Philadelphia and Baltimore and Washington and Boston. Never seen them or been anywhere near them. Hadn't even been to Chicago. So it was all very exciting.
That was 1938?
That was 38, yes, 1938.
What was Swarthmore like when you started there at that time?
Well, one thing about it was that we had very distinguished president of that school. It was Frank Adelot, and he was a famous American educator, and that's why Swarthmore was also at the top of these lists. He later became head of the American Rhodes Scholar Committee and director of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. This was part of my reason for choosing Swarthmore. He had instituted a program of study called the Honors Program there. And you'd take courses. Everybody took courses for the first 2 years. And then, generally speaking, the top half of the students, or probably pretty close to half, would only take two subjects at a time each semester, and they'd have seminars that might last all afternoon, or they might last a good part of the day, and it would be a small group of people, maybe 6-7 students, meeting with the professor. And it wasn't an assistant professor or somebody else, it was the professor. And you'd meet with him, and he'd pick your brains and cram things into your head. And it was an informal setting, and Well, you really learn things that way because he was giving you individual attention. We had a teacher-to-student ratio of maybe six.
Wow.
And these were professors. They were smart people who loved teaching because they weren't hired because they were great research scientists. They could have done research, but they loved teaching. And, well, that was good. You know, like if you went to a large school at that time, there'd be a big lecture, and the professor might give it once a week. In fact, when I was later a graduate student at Princeton, I became an assistant. I had a scholarship that got me teaching physics. I'd go once a week because to the lecture that the professor gave, and he had a student group of 100 people or so. He gave a lecture for an hour. That's what they saw of him. Mm-hmm. And then they would break up into smaller groups, like 20 or 25. I was a graduate student in chemistry, and I was teaching these kids, freshmen, physics in groups like that. I was only a graduate student in chemistry. So, you know, that's quite different from the Swarthmore style. I'm not knocking Princeton. It was a great very good place. But I'm just saying that Swarthmore gave attention to the students, which was remarkable. And when I finished Swarthmore and went to Princeton, and Princeton is a good university and it was well known in chemistry, I knew everything that they taught in first year courses. And I started with just a couple of the second year courses because I knew everything in some of the second year courses in chemistry. So I was ready for my PhD exam, the written exam, after 1 year at Princeton.
That's quite a testament then to your training at Swarthmore.
At Swarthmore.
Yes. Who were some of the chemistry faculty?
Well, the chairman of the department was H. Germain Maud Creighton, C-R-E-I-G-H-T-O-N. And he was a well-known electrochemist. And he gave the freshman chemistry lectures at that time. And we all remembered he paced back and forth from the lecture hall as he talked. Once in a while he stopped and write something by when he went back and forth. And some of the students would tick it off on them. They wanted to know how many times during the course of the hour lecture he went back and forth. There was a younger one who was a PhD in chemistry. His name was Walter B. Caton, K-E-I-G-H-T-O-N. And he is just remarkable in his devotion to teaching the students, and he had a great influence on it. There was another fellow, the organic chemistry professor, whose name was Edward Cox. And he was a tough fellow, and he wanted everybody to do better than they were already doing, and he stuck it to us. I didn't want to be an organic chemist, but boy, he was, those were the three principal ones. There was an analytical chemist, but, you know, those are the three big names.
What were the laboratory facilities like?
Not bad. They were, it was an old building, you know, built in the Dark Ages, and the laboratory stuff was not new and not remarkable, but it was very adequate. And so we had plenty of laboratory work. But the professor would come to the laboratory. I mean, anyway, didn't send it. It wasn't a graduate student there telling you what to do. The way when I was at Princeton, I sometimes assisted in the chemistry labs, but you know, the professor wasn't there. But these guys had come in a white coat to the laboratory, and they were going around looking over everybody's shoulders. So I felt that they did an outstanding teaching job, and I couldn't speak more highly of the quality of the education at Swarthmore.
You said you took a lot of physics and math at the same time.
Yeah, I really, when you arrived at Swarthmore, they said, you know what you want to major in? And I was... Not Well, I was pretty sure I wanted to be a chemistry major, but I wasn't. And the system was a chemistry major only started physics in the second year. I wanted to start physics right then and there. So I told Professor Creighton I didn't know whether I wanted to be a chemistry or a physics major, distorting the truth a little bit. So he said, well, then what, you ought to take physics, introductory physics, in your freshman year so that you could go either way, which is just what I wanted. So I started with both physics and chemistry. I guess my interest in physics increased a great deal while I was there because there was a assistant, he probably was an associate professor by the time I moved. His name was Elmore, and he was just as good as these chemistry professors that is working with the students. And so I found him an outstanding teacher, and the mathematics professors were outstanding. So I was enjoying myself thoroughly in all this. But when I finally started a working career after graduate school and went to Bell Labs, I found myself doing mostly physics. And then I sort of regretted that I hadn't been a physics major, but that was all right.
I'm intrigued by your comment earlier that you didn't get that much in the liberal arts.
Well, you can see how, if I was taking physics instead of some liberal arts course, mm-hmm. And working it to take more mathematics and more physics and more chemistry than were really in the book, there was only so much time during the day. Also, this honor system where you just had the two seminars, you should have gotten your liberal arts courses in your first 2 years, your freshman and sophomore years. I took them what was required, which is to learn German, and I had to take something in the humanities, so I took a year of English, and that was about it. Mm. My liberal arts consisted of two semesters of English courses, I picked out a couple, and German, and the rest of the time I was taking chemistry, physics, and mathematics.
Well, that means you had the flexibility to make those choices.
That's right.
Okay. A number of liberal arts schools, you don't have all that flexibility.
That's true. That's true. And I'm not sure that Swarthmore would give it to anybody now, but mm-hmm. I worked the system to what I wanted to do at the time, and I think they probably were a little startled to find that I hadn't taken more things, and later on, and it would have been very nice to have done it, but I was in a great hurry to get out of my subject and get on to graduate school and so forth.
How many majors, chemistry majors, were there? Was it a large number?
Oh, I would guess that there were probably, and it started at the same time I did, there must have been about 15 or so. See, the classes at Swarthmore had maybe 800 or 900 students at that time, and the classes were all quite small. And I would say that that was about the number, and about half of them, of the chemistry students, that let's say the top half, went into this honors program, and the other half continued in regular courses in the same subjects that we were taking, but not with the same intensity and not at the same level. So while we remained friendly with them and knowing them as fellow students, the ones that I was in close association with were the, let's say, the eight or so who were in the chemistry honors program. And so I got to know those people very, very well. We spent all our time together because we were supposed to take the same things. They would take the same physics seminars, the same mathematics seminars, and so we knew each other pretty well.
Did you get much laboratory experience during the seminar time?
Yes. They had laboratories, and they didn't neglect that. I'd say that the typical one in physical chemistry or organic chemistry, we would have one morning or afternoon a week in a seminar session. So that might be up to 4 hours. Mm-hmm. And then there would be a laboratory once a week, and we'd spend the whole afternoon in it, let's say from 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock. And that was true in physical chemistry, it's true in analytical chemistry, it's true in organic chemistry, it was true in physics. So we had full quota of laboratory experience.
Did you have a chance to do any independent research?
Well, not really, although some of the teachers had encouraged us to do a little bit more than the prescribed thing. I mean, they were trying to have a kind of an open-ended thing and would encourage us to do such things as go look up in the literature what here's something you want to synthesize or something you want to do. Why don't you go read about it and find out what the way to do it, and then come and tell me so that we didn't waste our time on a dead end or blow ourselves up or something. But that isn't independent research. They were encouraging us to be independent in our thinking, but they didn't. Set us to work on a long project. We had to plot, of course. That didn't happen. I guess later on it did, but it wasn't the fashion at that time.
The war started, I guess, you were in your junior year.
The war started, and I can remember exactly where I was, and the young girl who was studying with me one evening in the chemistry library, and who has been my wife since not too long after that, and I were studying, and we were the only ones in there, when one of the other chemistry majors and his girl, one that he's married to now, came into the library, and they looked kind of ashen, and they said, "Did you hear the news?" "No, what's the news?" And they told us about Pearl Harbor. They just heard it on the radio. Mm. And that was in December of our junior year. No, that was December of our senior year, because that was 1941, and I graduated in 42, so it was December of our senior year.
Okay. What effect did this have? I mean, were you worried about being drafted at that point?
Yes, I went to the... of course, I had the draft going, and both my brothers had been drafted. But first students, we were of an age that they weren't drafting us yet, and I went up and started at Princeton, only about the length of time that it takes to take the train up to get from one place to the other, and I started at Princeton. And then I was quickly swept in on, had a student deferment at first, and then they started drafting everybody. But the work that I was doing, and I had already started my thesis work, was considered worthy of deferment, because it related to the synthetic rubber program.